Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Always lead with your big snake. That's what I say.
Yeah. Yeah. If you got a succession of ever larger snakes, why would you ever send this? This is like something Cobra Commander would do.
I'll send my smallest snake. Surely, G.I. Joe.
No, send the overwhelm. Like, if you're Power Rangers, just go right to Megazord. Get the sword out.
Right,
stop fucking around. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Pulp podcast. This is a commission podcast. We're talking about the 2017 legendary fantasy historical film, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. This is from Commissioner PMH, which we'll be getting to their thoughts here briefly, or soon, in a minute. Not briefly. Well, whatever. We'll get to his thoughts. It's directed by Guy Ritchie. You might have heard of him, the director of Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels, Snatched, Rock and Roller, Sherlock Holmes, the Robert Downey Jr. saga, and the upcoming Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which I'm very excited for. He wrote the screenplay alongside Lionel Wigram and Joby Harold, who the only credit I recognize for him is the Obi-Wan Kenobi series, which... it stars Charlie Hunnam, who I really enjoyed in Pacific Rim. I know a lot of people know him from Sons of Anarchy. He's recently been in Zack Snyder's Rebel Moon. Also stars Astrid Berger Frisbee, who was the head mermaid in Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. Jimon Hounsou, who is the sturdy co-star of many a fantasy series. He got a start with Armistad and Gladiator. Gone on to be in some of my favorite films, Guardian of the Galaxy, Constantine, Stargate, and more. Game of Thrones alums Aidan Gillian, which is Littlefinger, as well as Michael McElhatton, Roose Bolton.
Oh, yeah.
Mikhail Persbrandt, who I only recognize as Bjorn from The Hobbit, which is one of the few sequences I actually enjoyed from those films. Also, the always handsome Jude Law. Loved them in Gattaca, Young Pope, got coverage of those. Eric Bana, one of my favorite actors who doesn't get to work enough. Troy, Munich, Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams reboot. Black Hawk Down is the first time I saw him as a Delta Force operator. With Kingsley Ben-Adir, who I didn't recognize, but he's the new Bob Marley in the Bob Marley biopic that's out now.
Oh, okay, yeah, now that you say it. I see that.
And bending it like himself, David Beckham shows up for a little cameo as the head guard for the sword pulling segment. I don't think it's a spoiler in a King Arthur film that at some point a sword gets pulled out of a stone.
God, I hope not.
Spoiler for our 700-year-old myth.
apparently at some point Guy Ritchie shows up in this movie too. Identify him though.
I didn't recognize him in motion, but he is the guy who owns the building that a certain attempt is staged from.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. This comes again from Commissioner PMH, who says, I love anything that Guy Ritchie directs. I think he has a distinct style that involves snappy, fun dialogue, editing, and not taking himself too seriously. He actually makes a cameo in the movie in a scene I think is quite funny. Other than that, many great cast members, including a couple characters you recognize from Game of Thrones, plus Jude Law, Charlie Hunnam, Eric Bana, and many others. Thank you for Commission PMH. I hope you enjoy this podcast. I've never seen this movie before. I don't know why, because it used to be all about the King Arthur, Robin Hood shit, that kind of like quasi-historical fiction. I love the Kevin Costner Robin Hood. I love the First Knight, you know, Sean Connery, Robert Gere. But at some point, I saw a bunch of turd ones, you know, like I didn't think much of the who's the guy on Gladiator, Russell Crowe, Robin Hood. And I kind of, I guess I got burnt out on him, and I saw this. I didn't know it was Guy Ritchie, and I just kind of like came and went. And I am glad I got the chance to re-see this because I really enjoyed it. I thought this was a hell of a lot of fun.
Okay, yeah, I can agree with a lot of fun. This movie's a lot of fun.
I'm not sure why it flopped. It this was intended to be the first of a six film series exploring, you know, fully fleshing out the the Merlin Arthur legend with the distinct Guy Ritchie, because it's this is very much a remix and kind of a reimagining of this world.
Yeah, surprise. I mean,
in a very Guy Ritchie way, and they gave this guy $150 million to make this film. It didn't even quite make that on at the gross, and the plans for all the series was promptly canceled. But again, just I don't understand. This movie is like a 30% on Rotten Tomatoes, and that just seems criminally low. I don't understand why anyone would not like this film.
I can see why a lot of people wouldn't like this film. A,
enlighten me.
It's not Guy Ritchie's best film by a long shot.
Well, okay, sure.
It has all the staples of Guy Ritchie in it, right? Like, it's got the scenes where you're going to get flashbacks and flash forwards as people are describing scenes that have happened. It's got a lot of really snappy dialogue and cuts to everybody in the crew and heist type stuff. It's got all of that. So it's very Guy Ritchie. But boy, is it like really trying for a style that I don't think works at all. I think I had fun with this movie. I don't think it's a good movie. I think it's a pretty bad movie, actually. Like,
really?
All of the CG. So I think the CG stuff really takes me out of it. And it's weird because, like, we're talking about a movie which is populated by giant elephants and beasts of all kinds. That are quite obviously like CG, but those don't look too bad. It's when we get to the fight scenes that I'm like, they're doing Burly Brawl shit here, but they're doing it poorly. Yes. They're somehow doing it 20 years later poorly. And
well, I think they did it exactly like Matrix Reloaded Burly Brawl, and that just, yeah, I guess that's like 10 years too late.
But they ramp into it just like way too fast. Like, the Burly Brawl doesn't start as what you think of as the Burly Brawl. The Burly Brawl starts with mano a mano, and it eventually ends up in this crazy place. This starts in the crazy place, and I think it's just too much for this story. This medieval fiction. I don't know. It's such a weird stylistic choice in a story that I've seen dozens of times. But even then, and another reason I don't think a lot of people might like this is because this is also a wild departure from even the stuff. Like, I know there's no like canon Arthurian legend really,
right?
But this is even a wild departure from the wildest departures I've seen. So, like, I don't know, man. I think this is not a crowd pleaser in any way.
See, I will never say this is a great film, but I think it's a good film, and I think it's a really fun and entertaining film. And to me, I kept on getting the impression that this is like First Night for him. It's got, like, you know, Magnetic lead and his rise to power. It's got a lot of like modern pop culture trippings and some music. But instead of being kind of like a romantic kind of heartthrob type of, you know, swashbuckling romance, this is just more of a straight up coming of age adventure.
I always confuse these. Are you talking about First Night or are you talking about A Knight's Tale? Okay,
Jesus
because
Christ, yeah.
I think A Knight's Tale is a better movie. It's more enjoyable. It has a tone
that
somehow matches more across the board than this movie does. This movie is trying to do a heist movie and, like I said, some crazy effects film and this medieval Arthurian legend, and none of it quite gels together perfectly. It's like they almost get there, but just not quite there.
I don't say that. I see what you're saying about the CG. I do think it was confined to that one fight. And also, I feel like people's
really
tastes are pivoting back from CG to more, like, I think the John Wick kind of started this, to where now it's like, you know, instead of like slowing down and bullet timing all the insane action, just do it at full speed. It's even better. Mm-hmm. But like, this was like one of those last. But the other thing is, like, ever since I've seen RRR, I guess I'm a little bit more forgiving with stuff that I can't quite believe if it's badass enough. And I think that when King Arthur has Excalibur in his hands and it's fully powered up, The style of that combat, just to over, it's like the good version of Sauron in the the backstory of the Lord of the Rings, where he's got the big scepter and he just swinging his arm and like 50 dudes go flying. Like, it's just yeah, because I've always like, what the fuck is up Excalibur? Why is it so powerful? Blah blah blah. This answers it. Like, Excalibur is just overwhelming force in this movie. When it being wielded by Arthur, and I just thought it was really cool.
Some of that stuff is very cool, yeah. I mean, the Burly Brawl is really, like, the biggest standout thing that I'm like, I don't think this looks good. Stylistically, it's strange. But so the other thing that, like, I will talk about some of the stuff I like, too, but the other thing that I think is weird and doesn't quite match is the narrative. I think, you know, they have a pretty good... Look, it's a hero's journey thing. This is a story we've seen dozens and dozens of times, but I thought it was a fairly compelling one, and there are a few shots of that journey that I thought were brilliant, like the Lady in the Lake stuff. I think stylistically that is as good as anything I saw in like the Northmen, or it was so epically metal that it just really blew me away, and it didn't rely on like crazy camera moves or anything. It was more like the music and the acting all just visuals, came together in that moment.
Very archetypal. It kind of almost reminded me of some of the shit you get that Denis Villeneuve gives up to into like the first Dune. Like, it just felt
like primordial, right? Just like,
yeah.
The raw. And that was awesome. But the narrative is decent. I think as a hero's journey, as far as those go, this is a decent one. It's something about like the pacing, I guess, of the rest of the film when it comes to the narrative that doesn't give the film time to breathe at all, because he's trying to do this rock and roll, this he's trying to do the Guy Ritchie thing in this movie, and he does it constantly. And so aside from that, like one moment with the Lady in the Lake stuff, I never really felt like any of the beats were landing before we were just onto the next beat. And that works in a movie that's all about that. But this movie wants to be more than that.
Yeah.
It's clear.
And I really dug the world building and the design. I thought the armor is really fucking cool. Like Jude Law's especially, his king armor, his men's armor looks like an evil version of Judge Dredd, or I guess a slightly more evil version of Judge Dredd's armor. If you want to call him an anti-hero. I liked like the sirens, the design of them.
Yes,
I like all the way that the mages used magic. I thought the magic looked very powerful and cool. I really thought the like you said, those giant fucking elephants. If you thought those
puny Lord of the Rings.
You think that's a big elephant? You think that's a big fucking elephant? No. Wait until you see these things.
Wait until Mordred conjures one.
And it was pretty well done. Like, I thought the cat, like, everything looked real. The armor looks good. The set and the world building was very exciting and cool. With one exception, which is I thought the tower stuff was hokey. But, like, because, like, in, you know, like, remember when we watched Masters of the Universe and the whole thing, Skeletor is trying to drain the Eterna Witch into its crystal or something. This is, like, an old fantasy trope where the villain's got, he's got to wait till the eclipse, or he's got to drain the life force out of a wizard into a crystal, or he's got to get all the six stones into the die. This guy's got to build a tower at a certain height, and then something happens. And I'm like, what the fuck? But whatever. It's just this candle that burns, or it's an hourglass that lets the hero know he's got so much time to do. I didn't think that really made sense. And I feel like they were trying to make a connection to this. Maybe I didn't quite understand what happened in the opening thing with the battle with the Dark Wizard or whatnot. But that's really the only thing that didn't work. I thought everything else was good. I thought, you know, it's a good looking young cast. The Guy Ritchie stuff like is pretty restrained. It's very strong in like three different sequences where it's like,
very.
This is the Guy Ritchie stuff. But this is like, I guess, the second thing I've really liked Charlie Hunnam in. Not that I've seen something I hated him in. It's just I haven't, you know, I didn't see Sons of Anarchy, like Pacific Rim.
I didn't either. Yeah.
But
he's really good. Yeah. I think like the acting across the board is very good. The CG for the most part is really good too. I'm actually surprised how well you can mesh modern effects with these medieval stories. And the thing that like makes it an even higher bar to clear, and I think they cleared it, is they're using some fairly modern musical techniques too. There's a lot of, let's say, a lot of non-classical instruments in this. It's a, it's a very breathy soundtrack. A lot of just people going as part of like the soundtrack. But there's also electronic stuff in there, and it somehow meshed way better than I thought it would stylistically.
This is something I don't notice on a lot of, you know, I don't comment on the music unless it really fucking impresses me. And this did, and I looked it up.
Yeah.
The guy who did the score, it's a great score. There's like everything from like Jim's breathy stuff to what I call like electric green sleeves, where it's like playing medieval music, but with
really
kind of sounds
string.
Yeah, but with a little bit of like timber and reverb and distortion to it. And Daniel Pemberton did this. He did The Trial of the Chicago 7, the soundtrack for Little Big Planet, all the Little Big Planet shows, which has excellent sound, and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and Across the Spider-Verse, which is another one that has an amazing... And once I saw that, I started, like, as I looked up at halfway through the movie, there's one particular cue. I'm like, this fucking music rocks. Who is doing this? And I saw that. I'm like, yes, this feels like it's got that DNA into it.
Because, you know, obviously, it works way better than it should.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It feels medieval, but also feels modern. And, I just really liked it. And, you know, Into the Spider-Verse, is everyone knows it by its visuals, but honestly, you know, it didn't have sound that was as good, that probably, you know, it wouldn't quite be as glorious. So, I got to keep my eye on this Daniel Pemberton, because he's done a lot of good work, a lot of good recent work. So,
is it weird to you that Guy Ritchie took this project on? I read that he wanted to do a Arthurian tale for a while, and he just never found the right thing to do it with, and so he does.
Is that like
here.
Every English director, like they want to do, like secretly? I just want to do a King Arthur. I want to do the definitive King Arthur.
Yeah, that or Shakespeare.
It did so when I sat down to watch this, I'm like, when I looked at the budget, $150 million, like, who the fuck gave Guy Ritchie $150 million to make a movie? And I was thinking, like, this was so out of his wheelhouse. But then I guess I was kind of wrong, because at this point in his career, so you've got, you know him from these low budget, like, you know, grimy English gangster films, Lock, Stock, Snatch.
He's an English Scorsese, as far as I'm concerned.
Revolver. I think he peaked in that format with Rock and Rolla. That's like the perfection of that format. And none of those are like big budget films. But then he got Sherlock, and that was like $100 million movie. Made a ton of money. He got a little bit more budget for Sherlock, a little bit bigger for Man from U.N.C.L.E. So he kind of worked his way up, because I don't think anything had... This is like the culmin of all the things he learned, because like none of those films... I know they had a lot of special effects, but nothing like this. This is like almost like a goddamn Dungeons & Dragons film, the type of effects and monster work and creature work and magic and shit, like loads and loads.
It's just like, why this guy though? Because then Disney gives him Aladdin, and I'm like,
well, that's another weird one.
About, you know, Guy Ritchie's work tells you that he's a good fit for Aladdin. I can think of 50 other directors who would be better fits for Aladdin than Guy Ritchie. He's like the bottom of the list to me, but they did it, and I know a lot of people don't like that. I enjoyed that movie about as much as I enjoyed this movie, honestly. Like, somewhere in the middle. I didn't think it was terrible, but I don't think it's great either. But yeah, it just seems weird. And then the there's two strange things about this movie. It's that Guy Ritchie did it, and the other one is, what is it about Arthurian legend where people are just like, let's get buck wild with this. Let's just go so far off the map of what we think of as classical Arthurian legend to make it almost unrecognizable. Why do people do that? I can't think of a more riffed on story than Arthurian legend.
I mean, it's the same reason people keep making movies about, I guess, Jesus, you know? It's like there's these archetypal things that, you know, this is like one of the, you know, the foundational mythos for a lot of the West, you know? You're talking about like France and UK and like English speaking world. This is a big cultural touchstone. So it's endlessly fascinating for those audiences. And these happen to be the biggest audiences.
But why change it? Why not remake it, right? Is it because it's like the one of the very few mythological legends we sort of have? Like, you go to China, you've got a lot of mythology, right?
Yeah.
But I suppose. The West, we have, yeah, King Arthur, and we got Jesus, and that's pretty much it.
Robin Hood.
I guess that counts.
It might be. But what do you mean by, like, why don't they just remake it? Because I think this is definitely playing jazz with the Arthurian. This is not Le Morte Arthur or whatever.
No, that's what I mean. Why don't they just, like, if they love the story so much, just make it. Make the thing like it's been made before.
I guess that's the answer. Like, you know, if you've seen Excalibur, you've seen the Merlin series on NBC, you've seen, like, it has been done, like, you know, to death. So, like, do something different with it. Just, like, play jazz. And I liked it because
But they don't do that with Robin Hood. Robin Hood doesn't get that treatment, right? Robin Hood doesn't suddenly become, like, a guy who rode dragons and shit. Like, King Arthur shit gets wild.
Well, I guess that's because, like, maybe is that part of the... There is a little bit more magic and legend. Like, you know, King Arthur goes to find the Holy Grail. I don't know if he outright, but he's got a wizard that works for him that lives backwards through time. There's witches. There's a little bit more magic. Like, you know, Robin Hood's best friend is a friar. It's not a wizard. He's fighting a king, not a demon sorcerer. Like, that, I just feel like it's, you know, like, look at the Green Knight. That's like a very literal adaptation of the Arthurian legend. He's got a giant tree monster and he's got to go in this dark, like, yeah. I think that's another way you can do it. Just, like, go super fucking accurate, like, you know, because, like, not many people have seen the side stories, and, like, I guess maybe to your point, they haven't seen a really faithful adaptation of the Arthurian legend. But also, what is the definitive Arthurian legend?
Right. And that's the thing. I was trying to do, like, research to figure out why people do this, and it seems like the Arthurian legend over the centuries has just been manipulated to hell and back. Like, kings would claim this Arthurian legend for themselves by putting them into retellings of the story and drawing themselves into, you know, sketches and paintings and sculptures and just make themselves out. Like, it's very utilitarian, this story, for the people in power. They can kind of frame it around themselves and give themselves more influence that way. So, yeah, I imagine that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah. And who knows, in 500 years, like, how much of this will contribute to the canon and how it'll continue to remix and that.
Sure, yeah.
It's also something that you can kind of set in almost any, like, you pick your aesthetic. Do you want, like, late medieval, early medieval, Renaissance? Like, you can put King Arthur in any, you can put him in a historical, like, you know, First Knight. We talked about
Knight's Tale.
Sean Connery and...
Oh, First Knight, okay.
And yeah, I'm back on the actual one.
I'm so confused by that.
The Armornette is, like, dumb. It's never, no one has ever worn, like, you know, essentially velvet vests with a bright silver pauldron. You know, that's your armor. But it's, all right, it's like Romeo and Juliet. That's a pretty malleable format that you can, you know, take very literally in a modern setting, like Romeo plus Juliet, or you can do it just like the stage play, or you could adapt it to, it's essentially, you know, West Side Story is kind of a Romeo and Juliet. So I don't know. I think this is it's certainly not stuffy.
Nope.
Which I think that's another problem that Arthurian legends that are super faithful can get. Like, I think Excalibur is a terrible film. I don't really like it.
We've covered Excalibur. I thought I remembered liking Excalibur quite a bit.
Maybe I did, and because I just remember hating it in high school, and that's my enduring memory of it.
It's got some weird shit in it, like the golden boy. I don't know what the fuck that's about. That's weird.
Son Mordred, which in this. So, we should probably get into the spoiler section so we can talk more about it.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet.
Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
So if you haven't seen this movie, it's King Arthur.
Right.
In this version, Uther Pendragon, Arthur's father, has got Excalibur, is given to him by Merlin. He's being attacked by an evil wizard by the name of Mordred. Camelot's under attack. And he's able, with the power of Excalibur, to drive the evil wizard and destroy him. But this was all a machination by his brother, who's played by Jude Law, Vortigern. And Vortigern uses the opportunity to transform himself through dark magic into a demon knight and slay Arthur and his wife. But fortunately, Arthur escapes like Moses down the Nile. As a 3-year-old boy, gets in a boat, floats down river. He goes all the way to Londinium, trying to get some historical accuracy. To modern day London, where he's taken in by a bunch of gold hearted whores who raise him in a brothel to be street smart and tough until he's a man full grown. And then prophecy's starting to get fulfilled. Swords are plucked from stones. Bingo, bango. Knights at a round table. And again, this is supposed to be the first of a 6-film hexology. Hexology. That's 6. Pentology would be 5. And it didn't make it. It didn't make any money. I guess it's lost Warner Brothers $150 million after distribution and advertising fees. And
they shouldn't have released it. They should have just cut it and wrote it off.
Well, they didn't know it was going to suck until they put it out there. And that's the thing. I'm sometimes shocked by Rotten Tomato scores, either being very, but you always remember, it's like, well, it's just not. It's 90% doesn't mean that the average critic's review is 90%. It just means 90% of critics liked it. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat shocking that only 3 out of 10 critics like this movie walking out of it. I don't know why it's offensive about it, you know?
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't have to be offensively bad. It just has to be more bad than good. And I don't even know if I would label it that. I'm like right down the middle on this one.
You said that the story doesn't hang together.
Stylistically,
what?
Yeah. No, the story hangs together. Like, it's okay. Narratively, it's fine. I have no problem. It's a pretty standard hero's journey and a fairly effective one. It's stylistically, none of this stuff really meshed to me. Hmm. Like, when you're trying to tell this narrative of this hero's journey and the style of heist film is getting in the way of it, it's like,
I don't, because you keep on saying it's a heist film. I didn't get that. There's like, I guess, a scene where it's like a kind of a heist or an assassination plan, where, and that's very Guy Ritchie, where You know, it's like that thing they do on the Archer series where people finish each other's sentences going into different scenes. And this, it's like every edit is like Arthur starts to say a sentence and then they cut to a different angle and someone else is finishing that sentence and then they cut it. And they but that was the only part I like. I didn't get that this is a heist movie.
Well, they do that multiple times, trying to be, right? There's the scene where Arthur is describing how he's going to get all these other people on his side or how it's going to go when they try and get these minor lords. I have no idea who these people are, but the people of the land, the rulers to back them. And he says, well, then I would say, and they cut over to him actually saying it in that scene. And then he would reply and I'd be forced to tell him why he's a sack of shit or whatever. And it would ultimately end up in us just going and doing this other thing. Okay, it's not heist in the strictest sense of the term, but it's that style of a scene, right?
I guess it's like, I thought that this is just Guy Ritchie flourish, where it's like Sherlock Holmes, when he's in slow motion breaking down what he's going to do to his boxer. That's the same format, but it's not a heist. It's just
I'm using the word heist. Yeah, to stand in for the editing. And I think it's the pace of everything. Like, you'd never get any real breaths to feel like you're understanding Arthur's plight here, right? Like, it's just one thing after another, constant downhill slalom for this movie. And I don't know, I think that gets in the way, because some of the moments I like the most are when the occasion when the movie does slow down a little bit, like the stuff with Backlack, I think is his name, and Little Boy Blue or whatever the hell his name is, the father and son duo there. I think when the movie slows down and you have those quieter scenes, it's a much better movie. And well, it's not much better. It's just it feels more right to me. And I feel like I'm learning who these people are, as opposed to them just snap cutting to everybody around the circle finishing each other's sentences.
I guess it feels more like a traditional Arthurian film, and I agree. I think the Lady of the Lake sequence is a standout, but to me, I wouldn't want the whole film to be like that. I like the fun Guy Ritchie, and I think it's appropriate when Arthur's at his low point to have this kind of like super stylistic, super mythological scene that kind of like bucks him up and puts him back on mission. Like, he's literally, I mean, this is, you know, pretty basic story circle, know, hero of a thousand, but like, he's literally meeting the goddess and, you know, crossing the threshold and being transformed. And
I feel so like there were like four thresholds he crossed, but yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. But yeah, I wouldn't want it to be like that, because then it's going to be some kind of plotting operatic thing like Excalibur, and not this very exciting swashbuckling D&D flavored. I mean, I thought
it's a choice for sure.
Yeah. Like, this isn't quite as much fun as the Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, but I think it's in that ballpark of, like, just snappy dialogue, good-looking people, and good-looking armor. I can't say enough about the armor, man. The design is thing. I thought Excalibur looked badass. Like, the effect that Arthur and anyone, I guess, the true king has when he picks up and their eyes kind of glow and they get kind of go into Super Saiyan mode, I thought that was really fucking cool.
Yeah, I like the effects everywhere except for that Burly Brawl. I think the Burly Brawl sucked, but everything else, even the weirdly glossy animal stuff that happens, like creature-based stuff, I think there's like a sheen across this entire movie that's a little too polished or a little too glossy, a little too, like, CG, for lack of a better term, but ultimately, like, not that much. It actually worked pretty well.
I want to talk about some of the CG stuff that did work for me. We already talked about the giant elephants, but those things are just fucking amazing. Like, the way they're using their... Because the first thing is, like, you see them, like, what the hell is this even?
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, God, that's an elephant trunk. Wait a second. That fucking trunk has got to be, like, 100 feet long. And then you see the whole animal, and it's got, like, a whole castle that has, like, this giant, like, factory that's gouting, shooting fire. That shit was so cool. I thought the big snake was fucking awesome. Like, John Voight would never be. I mean, do you think Anaconda's big? This thing is huge. It had a great sound. I love how, like, they just had this picture of, like, Charlie Hunnam in the middle. You know, like, he's just standing there protected by the mage's charm as this thing is just going like a whirlwind and just biting dudes in half and and killing guys. I thought that stuff was cool.
I love the siren. The siren is super cool.
Yeah, because you're like, what the fuck is this even? You know, yep. You've seen it slither up a couple times, but they never kind of show, and then it flops on, and then it's like, oh, it's some kind of like, and then it's like, oh, it's like three of them in like some kind of writhing leech ball.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Very creepy.
Oh, yeah. No, that stuff's awesome. I like the mixing in of like Kung Fu George. I like some of the, you know, the everybody's got a nickname, yeah. Right? Like you got Goose Fat Bill, who's mm-hmm. Aiden Gillen, who mm-hmm. Is Littlefinger in Game of Thrones. I love the nicknames, and I love like those anachronisms where like, oh yeah, this dude is just some Middle Ages guy teaching all of his dudes Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird thing. Yeah.
I like how they made Londinium like even more cosmopolitan than it probably was. Like, you know, you got Jaman Hanzu as the essentially the head knight of Pendragon, and like the Kung Fu George is very cool. He's got these, you know, essentially a gladiator pit that he's teaching to do wushu.
Everybody's calling each other mate all the time, which feels, yeah. You know, very Guy Ritchie, but also fun.
I had on my notes that, like, I think you can make any film a Guy Ritchie film by just finding and replacing every instance of TH with F, and sure. Then just add mate to every other line. You know, what yeah. You doing with both of them swords, mate? You know, it's like that's you're dead. You're halfway there. You're halfway there.
Oh, yeah.
You got it. You got to chop and screw the edit and the dialogue now so that yep. The one flows from the other. No edit lasts longer than a quarter second, and you're good.
Yeah, but that stuff's fun. I did enjoy, yeah, those Guy Ritchie-isms in this movie.
I also kind of like how King Arthur starts out as Pimp Arthur. Like, for the first third of this movie, he's just running a brothel, man.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought the King Arthur forging montage, where he starts off as a boy and he's trying to be a good boy and doing jobs, but he keeps getting beaten up and robbed by the older urchins, and he stands his ground, and it reminded me of a little bit of the King Leonidas coming of age sequence from 300, where he's sent out as a small boy and he has to kill the wolf, and it's like that, only Guy Ritchie did it. So it's like 60 seconds long, but it takes you from a three-year-old boy to full-grown strapping Charlie Hunnam, and just seeing the little progress he makes from, you know, where he gets a little sneakier and craftier, he's building, you know, building this giant fortune, which that didn't really go anywhere, I thought.
Yeah, it goes nowhere, because the king just finds it and destroys it or takes it or
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, I was like, I wonder if he's going to get so much gold and he's going to be able to do blah, but nah, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, no, I like it. It's an effective montage. It shows the kid, like, he starts off, he's kind of scrawny, he's getting bullied by other street urchin kids. Mm-hmm. And like you said, he has to get craftier, because he's not big, he's not strong. And so he's got to be sneakier. Still doesn't work, but over the years you see him growing up, you see him not just getting smarter but also getting stronger, and then it ends with him, you know, overwhelming his bully, I guess,
yeah,
with his strength.
There's a couple predictable things, like the second that the siren said, you know what the price you have to pay for our assistance, like the second they did that and showed Jude Law's Vortigern having a, you know, a relationship with his daughter, I'm like, oh, she's going to be thrown in this fucking water by the end of the film. Obviously that happens. But I thought Jude Law did a really good job of just being Jude Law and connecting to, like, you know, he's obviously this ambitious evil guy, but because he's Jude Law, he's got a little bit more poise and finesse and refinement, and I do believe he loved his daughter. He did, you know. The big problem I have is his motivation is just to accumulate power. I wish they had articulated what he wanted to do with it.
Gotcha.
You know, he's just trying to get power but why? Do you want to rate lower taxes? You got the power. You're jealous of your brother's power. You've got more power than your brother ever had. You're building this tower for more power.
Yeah, I thought it was, when the movie opens, I thought it was going to be, oh, he hates mages, but he's becoming Mordred. He's becoming a mage by the end of it, and that seems to be his goal. So that's not it.
And to kill and to be the only mage left. Like, after he came to power, he had all the other mages put to death. except for, I guess, Merlin's one acolyte, the mage that... Mm-hmm. Like I said, I got a wild hair a couple of years back. And I'm like, yeah, I have a lot of fun in the Pirates of the Caribbean. I never saw anything after three. I'm going to watch them all. Watch all five Pirates of the Caribbean. And I remember her being the mermaid, and that's the only thing I've seen her in. But I thought she was really effective. She's got this kind of haunted, frail, like, I like my magic users to look like they're heroin addicts. You know, like there okay. is a that there's a cost to this. You just can't sure. sling this vast power for nothing. It takes something from the your physicality. And she plays that, you know, like big eyes, dark circles under them, solid, mm-hmm. like looks like she hadn't seen sunlight in 300 years. Looks like she
looks
might be
painful when she uses her magic. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I apparently they cast her originally as Guinevere, and I looked into trivia and they don't really specify why, but it wasn't working. So Guy Ritchie re-envisioned her as the mage so she can be this kind of like just mysterious figure that's helping through this fantastic power that she's got.
Yeah, I like probably that. To smooth the edges off that in subsequent films, which they never got.
Yeah, and there was some like down to earth. Like, I really like the idea of her using that snake to infect Charlie Hunnam with like a magical spell, a charm that keeps the other snakes from him.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going with the multiple vision quest thing. Like, he's got to meet the lady in the lake. He's got to keep his eyes open so he can see his father killed or his father's sacrifice or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then he's also got to go on a vision quest with Snake Venom. It seemed like he had a lot of layers to peel on this hero's journey. And it was kind of a little too much.
I'll tell you a couple of guys. I said the tower I thought was kind of hokey. It was an unforced error by the mage to send a smaller snake. Because like if that smaller snake doesn't come up and like alert Jude Law and splash blood on, because I guess that's the thing, that splash blood and his blood protected him as well. That snake just comes and fucks everything, fucks everybody up, and the movie's over.
Probably.
Why the backup snake? The jump the gun. Maybe you send the backup snake after the big snake's wrecked and like, okay, you just winged Vortigern. You gotta bite him in the heart to kill him. But like, you sent the small snake. You sent the snake that Excalibur couldn't kill this big snake.
Yeah, no, you're right. You could have done it.
I thought it was weird.
Always lead with your big snake. That's what I say.
Yeah, yeah. If you got a succession of ever larger snakes, why would you ever send this? This is like something Cobra Commander would do. I'll send my smallest snake. Shelly Gija. No, send the overwhelm. Like, if you're Power Rangers, yeah. Just go right to Megazord. Get the sword out. Right, stop fucking right. around.
Yeah. Rita couldn't take a blast from Megazord.
No. You let her level up. You let her build mm-hmm. up tolerance. The Zords, then shouldn't. But yeah, you come up with a 300-foot robot with a 600-foot sword. Done. Done season one, episode one.
That's probably goddamn why they don't
Power
do
Power Rangers. Teenagers that... I really liked Demon Knight design. I think Jude Law's the Demon Knight looked like a Dark Souls boss.
Absolutely.
Right down to the twin blade scythe that transformed into two separate sickles at the climactic moment of the big fight. I thought that was really cool.
That or really reminded me of the cover of Skyrim, I think it is, with the...
Mm.
There's a very demon-looking knight on the front of that thing.
Yeah, the level one armor you start with.
right. Looks cool though.
Yeah. And I thought there's a couple other really gifts to I really like the expansion of the Arthurian lore. I love the idea that Arthur or that Pendragon's own body became the stone that held the sword.
Oh yeah, that's cool.
That was a really fucking cool idea that the sword came flying in the air and he takes to his knees and it like, you know, does the Roman style execution. And then now he turns into stone. It's so heavy. It crashes through the pier. And
do they grab it and move it outside or do they drain that?
They don't explain it.
It doesn't look like it's in the same location, but they must have moved him.
I think they say that the, you know, because like they just show the scene of the water receding, and then there's a scene of Jude Law asking, I forget what the lady that's kind of like a half mage in his court. It's like, why are the waters receding? No, he asked the sirens, why are the waters receding? It's like, the balance must be maintained. And
but aren't
really
those the same waters that Arthur was in when he like he uses the siren multiple times, even after the waters recede. But I thought Arthur died in the location where the sirens were. Am I wrong about
that? No, I think that is in the basement of the castle. It's like a cistern at the bottom of
the
castle.
Same
Arthur, I didn't think so. I thought that was like at the edge of the castle and it's like the docks, I guess. The docks. It was the docks. It had a little harbor opened up into.
Okay. I mean, if that's the case, yeah. I read those as the same location, but
I will say I think it's a little bullshit that that's a cool idea, but it there's nothing into the stone that Arthur actually pulls the sword out of that indicates that was once a human being. Like, sure. I mean, maybe I need to go back and rewatch it to see, but like, I felt like they cheated a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they couldn't make it look exactly like it or, you know, but I don't know. They could have buried it in the mud a little bit more or have it. Maybe they did. I just like, it's a great idea. I just didn't know if it tracked back to the David Beckham scene where he's pulling the sword out.
Yeah, it made it feel more like a sacrifice for his son that he knew would inevitably happen than just like he lost that fight, you know? It made it look like he won that fight. It just took X number of years, took 20 years.
I thought it was a nice touch too when Jude Law grabbed Excalibur and he killed the sword, the snake that was on the column, but that sword embedded itself and now it's back in stone and only Arthur can pull it out. I thought that was a really cool touch.
Mm-hmm.
Another question I had is in the beginning of the movie, I'm not sure why they let Uther Pendragon, who's played by Eric Bana, who, again, I really like him. I think he landed the very small part with a lot of gravitas and a lot of warmth. But he just essentially 1v1s the Dark Wizard's entire army. And it wasn't clear to me, because that's before you knew the power of Excalibur. I don't know why they didn't show like Excalibur really kicking ass, because he just seemed like he just jumped up onto the elephant's back, came into the front door, and everyone just like let him waltz in and chop the main dude's head off. And
yeah,
do you think
they
were
just
afraid?
Wanted to preserve that for later in the movie.
I thought it was a mistake.
Arthur's
journey.
Yeah,
I thought that was kind of dumb. And I think if you got an early flash of like how powerful Excalibur was, and then, you know, you could really expand and elaborate that in other scenes. Because I think that would have, the stuff that they do in the mid and in ported films could have easily been outdone that in terms of like style and action. But
yeah, because you do want to understand that he's more powerful than his father at some point, right? Because if he's going to beat the knight, the guy I was calling Skeletor the entire time, Jude Law, Vortigern, whatever.
Uh-huh.
If he's going to defeat him, he's got to be. It could be kind of like video games where they give you, just like they unlock everything for you at the very beginning, right? You're this super powerful thing and you get to mess around with that and see how cool it is. And then they strip everything from you and force you to level back up to get it all again. It could have been like that, I suppose, but I don't know. It worked for me. I guess I didn't need to see how he killed Mordred.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, I just need to see a power, because I at first I thought, well, this is stupid. How did this giant army is destroying all of Camelot and this one guy just comes and he's got a magic sword, but it just glows, and like what is the deal here? I thought it would have been cool to see him actually kind of cut a swath through the army to do that. Or
didn't feel like their army was much of an army. It was really two big elephants, and once the elephants lost their connection with Mordred, they were just elephants.
Yeah.
Or potentially they disintegrated. I don't know, because I thought he conjured them, but like,
because
did
they
go back to the mountain or?
Yeah, he did. He conjured them literally out of mountains. They weren't there, and then they break out of the mountains. So yeah, did they just go back or did maybe? Yeah, you're right. Might have been
now they roam the countryside, or yeah, they disintegrate. I don't know, but it didn't seem like he had much of an army. It was really just those two big ones, and once you deal with those.
Yeah.
Uther's army is way stronger.
I like the assassination attempt. I thought, you know, it's very rare that you see what is his name? Aiden Gillian. It's rare you see him as a just a purely good guy.
Yeah, he's great.
There is Arthur being betrayed by his friends is a very core part of the art. And as soon as he showed up, I'm like, oh, he's going to fucking betray him in the third act. And he never does. He never does.
I mean, he never betrays them. He kind of fucks them.
Especially since what at the assassin when?
Yeah, the assassin when he just taking pot shots and gives away the location and then forces him to fight their way out. Yeah.
What's his name? Weiss or something. You're right.
That's not really a betrayal. That's just. Yeah.
Especially when they're like, oh, they call him Goose Fat because he's always able to escape whatever prison King Vortigern. I'm like, there's no fucking way this guy's sneaking out. Vortigern keeps on letting you. This is like a criminal informant, man. I was shocked that we got to the end of that film and he didn't betray anybody. Other than, like I said, being a little impetuous.
It's his smirk. He just has a constant smirk.
I think it's just
even
a
when he's.
I've never seen him play. The only time I've seen him play good guy is in the third Batman, and Bane throws him out of plane like 30 seconds in. Like I've never seen him more than a minute of good, pure-hearted screen time, and now I got two hours.
True. Yeah, that's true. No, I love him as an actor. He's great. I do really love that assassination scene. I think that is maybe, aside from the Lady in the Lake scene, the best scene in the movie for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I also like
there's so
the
much
whole...
tension there and the payoff being that he's going to kind of fuck this up by being by seeking revenge here just really makes the whole thing work because they tease it too at the beginning. He's like lining up a shot and everybody's like, hey Bill, come on, we're here for a reason, and that's going to give away our position, and he backs off in the moment, and then when they realize they're not going to get their shot, he's like, well, I got a shot, I'm going to take it. Yeah.
Yeah. What a dick.
He wasn't willing to fuck up their mission, but when he realizes their mission wasn't happening, he's like, I'm here, I'm going to do it.
Screw yeah, there's this, he's, I got the head of the blacklegs here, I'm going to take him out. And I also, there's two things I liked. I really liked how everyone is dismissive because they're like, you know, what's the longest shot you can make? He's like 75. the one guy is Bob Marley. He's like, I can probably hit from 75 yards. And then, Goose Fat Bill kind of mumbles like 175, but it's like, oh, you can't shoot any further. And he's like, no, I said 175. And everybody's like, you can't make a shot accurate. And the next scene is Arthur's two guys. Like, he's like, he said, just go out until he signals. It's like, I can't even see him anymore. And they're having this debate about, and then all of a sudden, thump, it hits the bullseye and they start screaming. You could have killed. And then as they're mid scream, another one comes.
And he's like, maybe they thought that one was luck, which I love that line.
It is a great
line. In hands
line.
Of another arrow, yeah.
It's a great line. And then the whole, he's like, all that, and you fucking missed. I didn't miss. And you see the little trickle of blood come out. So the guy just like, I guess he just went right through his neck clean.
I don't know where he hit him. I couldn't really tell.
I kept thinking they would reveal it, but it was a little badass detail that he, you know, looked like he missed both targets. And then there's just that little trickle of blood and he falls over. Pretty sweet. I love a good archery scene.
And then they're running away. They're trying to get out of the city. That's really cool too. I thought the chase scenes were good. It always felt like they were one step ahead. And I love how like you've got
good
this huge army
space
in the city.
And geography too. Like I felt like I'm going through this, and they had those rocket things that kind of like tracked the progress. It was well conceived chase.
And you get this big army in the city, but you're only going to really encounter little clumps of dudes who you can kind of handle, you know, with the element of surprise, you can run up and they do some running punches. They're just like, I don't even know if the blacklegs realize that they're there before they've been punched in the face and gutted. Mm-hmm. And it's really funny.
I do wonder how effective it is to punch someone that's wearing like a cast iron mask.
Not very.
They're wearing like steel plate masks and just conk. I was like, that's gotta
maybe the force
hand,
would knock them to the ground and surprise them, but it's not gonna hurt him. Yeah.
I think that's what Toranaga was talking about, being broken through the fist.
Yeah, broken on Shogun. The fist.
On Shogun this week.
Yeah, good stuff there. And then they get to Kung Fu George. In that scene,
yeah.
It kind of culminates with they retreat to Kung Fu George's spot here. He doesn't want them to fight. He wants them to run and hide, leave through the tunnels with him, but they won't. They've been looking forward to fighting the Blacklegs their entire lives. They've been training, and now's their opportunity.
I think King Arthur, if he was any leader at all, could have been like, I know you guys are fucking murder nuts, but if you come down this tunnel with me, you can have your ultimate revenge. Like, they just essentially waste their lives.
Yeah.
When
a bunch of them.
When King Arthur could have hulked out with Excalibur at any time.
That's the thing. Well, he couldn't, right? He needed to be desperate enough. This is the hero's journey. He needed to be forced into. Yeah.
Because the power of it's so overwhelming that you just black out at first. Because that's the other thing. When I was surprised at that, when he pulls out, I thought he was going to be able to escape with Excalibur, but he just blacks out because it's so powerful. And then they take him in chains and do this big public square, which that's one of my favorite scenes, because I thought, that's where you first see Vortigern in all his armor, and they get this cast of thousands and this really cool plaza thing with this elaborate like chopping block for people's heads, and I'm like, I wonder how the hell he's going to get out of here. And then everyone that's interested in the prophecy of the heir shows up and just bails him out without him even knowing they're allies. That was, I thought, kind of cool too.
There was a small there were rumors about it, and show up. I was kind of, so one of the things that like the pacing of this movie might get in the way of the narrative a little bit is I wasn't sure about the blacking out stuff. So the blacking out happens because he as a child doesn't want to remember the thing that he saw.
Is that what happens?
Well, this is my question. Yeah, this is a question. I don't know, because I think everything moves so fast and they show just glimpses of it. That I never got a full understanding of why he was blacking out, why a snake bite would help with that, how he overcame any of that. He really just like had to grab the sword 3 times, and then he got
I got completely,
but she says,
different
like,
idea.
You can't close your eyes. She says, don't close your eyes. And this child in the flashback opens its eyes, sees his father, and his father says something to him and throws the sword up and sacrifices himself. It's a little messy. Just because I didn't think they spent enough time on it.
I got that, like, yeah, that's, I think that works more on a thematic level than a literal level, that because I don't literally think. At first I thought, oh, you assume something happened because you closed your eyes, you weren't able to look, and then something else actually happened. But I think that, I don't think his dad literally threw the sword up in the air. And obviously King Arthur wasn't there to catch it. So I think that was like him getting his confidence. Like, cause at first he doesn't believe he's Arthur. Mm-hmm. Then he doesn't believe he's worthy of the sword. And when he finally gets like to this desperate point with Vortigern, he does feel like the heir and worthy to wield Excalibur, and he's able to kick the guy's ass. But until his dad kind of like gave him the wink and like, you're my boy, you're made for this. But yeah,
but didn't he always see that? So it was in his own head. He just didn't want to believe it.
I think he closed his eyes.
Very real, like all of the stuff that happens there really actually happened, because he has the scars on his hands.
Yeah.
From where he gave the sword back to his father.
Right,
so like,
and his dad whipped it out of there. Yeah.
All of that literally happens. It's just he didn't want to face his own destiny, become the hero.
He didn't see the moment of his father's death is what I took it. Like he imagined what it would look like a bunch of times, but that's why he didn't know that his dad's body was the sword, I guess. Or his dad's body was the rock.
And
that
he is the true king? The born king or whatever they call him?
I think so. Okay.
Yeah, but, like I said, I think it could have been a little cleaner. But
you might be right about the closed eyes thing, that snake venom helped with that too. But I thought that was just like she's trying to like essentially like the way you treat a shock victim. Like, don't close your eyes. Don't go to sleep. You can't stay conscious until you fight through the venom. And
you have
that
to face
was the charm. That was such a freaky scene. This snake just biting his neck and just pumping in venom while she's giving them this pep talk.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the 4 pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
Yeah, I honestly expected a little bit more of the rest of the movie to just be like some vision quest. But it didn't really feel like it was, because he goes directly from that to Vortigern's castle.
Yep.
And surrenders again with the giant snake.
Yeah. Is a little, I guess that's the other thing, is like maybe structurally it's a little hokey that I didn't buy that Vortigern would let the mage go. And being like, you know, Hanzu's like, who plays Belvedere, he's like, oh, the boy can't do anything without the sword, and you've got the sword, so let the girl go. And I was like, did he not know that she was a mage? He did, right?
I'm not 100% sure, but I thought so.
I just don't understand why he would let such a powerful piece go. Like, the gain, what, he's already got the sword. He's got the girl. Like, I feel like getting King Arthur is just a matter of time. But was there some kind of, he had to build the tower first? I also thought that there's a couple things also missing, because I was starting to get the opinion that his tower was like built from the stones of the empires he was conquering. And like each level added, because they mentioned like you have to finish the top by getting the stone from Gaul. And I thought that was going to be a bigger part of it too, that like, you know, I got to get a stone from every conquested territory to build the whole temple, and that's like, it's the blood of my enemies. Yeah. The whole tower, again, it's a MacGuffin, it's a timer for the movie, but I thought it wasn't, and it somehow was mirrored the tower that Mordred built in his Dark Kingdom, but I wish they'd made a few cleaner connections to that.
There's some kind of weird connection that I didn't understand between Vortigern and the magic use, where he gets a headache any time that magic is used around him. He gets it both early on in the movie, where it's clear, you know, he made a pact with the siren, with the spilled blood, and when Mordred uses his magic when he's nearby, he gets a headache. But then later in the movie, when the mage is using her magic, he also gets that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't quite understand what was going on there.
You're right, because didn't he even have like a trickle of blood coming out of his nose in the opening scene when Uther Pendragon killed the wizard?
I think so.
And I think, so like, I've only seen this movie once, but my understanding is like because he had a connection to Mordred. And when Arthur beheaded him, that's what caused that injury. And the time where he was about to behead Arthur, and then the mage attacked made the horses and the dogs go berserk, I thought that was just her deliberately attacking him to kind of befuddle him.
Huh.
That was part of the magic she was casting. and he's trying to resist it because
potentially, because he's turning into a powerful mage as well. I don't know. Yeah. It's another one of those.
I think
they would have spelled it out more in the subsequent five movies, but
maybe. The thing. The tower, I felt like they needed this because, like, that's obviously a one and done. And I think Vortigern's, like, motivations, because if anyone else but, like, Jude Law and a handful of other actors, this would have been a pretty thankless role because he's just one dimensional. He's just evil.
I agree. I think he needed this role.
Like, why? Because I believe he loved his wife, and I really believed he loved his daughter. What is so important to sacrifice them for? Just power for power's sake? I didn't buy that. I needed him to need something, or like to see that Arthur was maybe not taking a threat like the Vikings seriously enough. And he, you know, he feel like he needed to get more power for England to repulse the Vikings or something to give him a little bit more dimension.
Yeah, the only glimmer I saw of motivation was early on in the movie where they've defeated Mordred and they're starting to question, like, do we punish all mages for this, or we just punish the mage? And you can see Arthur's kind of leaning toward just punishing, or we dealt with Mordred, we don't have to punish the rest of the mages. But he doesn't think that's the way to go, quite obviously. You know,
yeah, he wants to kill them all because he wants to be the only mage.
Yeah, and they also I think that is the motivation, but it's dubious.
That he graduated from mage school and, you know, you're a mage. But again, why is that the motivation? That was to kill all the mages, but it's not because he hates them. It's because he wanted to be the only one. He wanted to have all the power.
Sure. Which I guess makes sense.
So did they kill Merlin? Did they establish that, or is he?
Merlin's not even in this, is he?
Well, they name check him, and I believe the mage was Merlin's, like, chief acolyte.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure if Merlin had been killed.
I think they were saving Merlin for in the future movie. No.
Or he was just off the board in hiding.
Yeah. I think that the latter is true.
Okay.
But that's so weird. That's, like, one of the riffs on, like, that's the riff, right? Merlin is pretty involved in this whole story. Like, throughout the entirety of this narrative in the typical Arthurian legend, this is a pretty wild departure that Merlin wouldn't even be involved in any of this stuff.
I think you're right. I do think I saw a couple reviews that seemed to be angry that they shouldn't have tried to make sequels and they should have spent all their time shoring up the first movie. I didn't feel like this movie begged for a sequel. If I saw this movie, I would have thought, well, that's a standalone King Arthur film. I didn't think there's any connections to a future movie other than if you want to say they're saving Merlin to reveal in a later movie.
Yeah, probably.
But that's I was like, I didn't think anything was missing from, like, I thought that was like I felt like they had read the press release or the press packet before they watched the movie and got pissed because they didn't like the movie. And they're like, I challenge you to name tracks. Like, I was like, is there a post-credit sequence or something? I fast-forwarded it. No, is that like
the building of the round table? I mean, that feels like maybe it's just because we're so familiar with the legend as a whole, but that feels just like happily ever after, right?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's like Kirk getting a new ship at the end of the last star. It's like, you know, first star straight on to morning. It's like he's
riding into the sunset.
Continuing voyages. It's not like, oh, we're going to get more films. It's like, this is, you just saw the Legend of Sword, how Arthur came to power, and we know what he's going to do next. It's around. Yeah, I thought that's exactly what I thought. It played as a, like you said, happily ever after, riding off into the sunset.
Which is not all happy after that, and they didn't
establish a new threat. You know what I mean? They didn't establish the forces of Vortigern are still, or Vortigern had a son, or
those elephants are still out there rampaging.
The sirens are conspiring to bring balance back to evil. None of that. It was just like, that's the movie.
No, it felt standalone. I don't feel like I missed out on anything not seeing this, not seeing the subsequent five movies. Kind of along the lines of the, you know, weird stuff with Vortigern we've been talking about. There's this, like, I can't tell what happens when he turns into this Hell Knight. Are they in a different realm? Because at some point, like, Arthur puts the sword in the table or whatever, or his dad does. I can't remember what it is, but it seems like they go to an entirely different realm of existence.
Yeah, like that was at the base. So that was at the base of the tower, and for some reason we went into the tower, Excalibur activated and like made the tower disappear, and now they're in the middle of the fucking ocean on an island. Yeah, it had to be.
What is with that? But then the effects of that ring in the real world as well, because you see the tower go catch a blaze at one point.
Yeah, I'll see you that and raise you one more. What the fuck is the Darklands? Was that a different dimension that he went to, or is that like a real part of the world? Or
it felt to me like it was a real part, but I don't know.
Connected that like some kind of magical barriers crossed, and now you're into the infernal plane or some shit like that. Again, I was also like, did I miss something with this tower? Is it supposed to be the gateway between the Darklands? And because I kind of thought, also had this theory that maybe Mordred came from the Darklands, and he was trying to build a tower but again, I don't fucking understand the tower, so
yeah,
I can't help you any more than that.
It's a little confusing. I also had another question around how Vortigern knew. Is it Guinevere? Is Guinevere the wife of Uther, who becomes his wife?
No, she gets thrown off the cliff. I know you're talking about. I don't know who she is either, because she's in like.
Oh right, she gets killed. No, the woman in the blue
dress.
It's
Maggie, right? Is that
sure? The blonde woman. I think she's in a blue dress. She's the one who betrays Vortigern to the band of Arthur's guys. Tells him, hey, he's going to be on his boat at this location. You can get him. How does he get wise to her treachery? Because they just have him say, haha, you're treacherous.
I don't know. Magic? Because you're right. Yeah. Like, set up the assassination attempt, right? And then sets up a trap suddenly. He's got a spare double there.
He's wise to it, and he, you know, talks a bunch of smack to her, and I'm just like, how did he figure this out? Maybe magic.
The sirens wouldn't help him, because they just did all, so they're like, we helped you become the Demon Knight, now you build the fucking tower, then you'll have all the power.
Yeah.
A tower of power, if you will.
Sure. I got one other thing that I just wanted to note.
Okay.
And it's just... how cool. There are two very cool scenes. Very, very cool, like, conceptual things. I think one is the just apocalyptically cool Lady in the Lake scene. But the other one I love, not just that his father turns into the stone, but the industrial scale, find me the man who can pull this out of the stone operation that he's got going on.
Yeah.
Every single person across the land of a certain age who would have been born at the time that Arthur was born is brought to this location, and they attempt to pull the sword out, and it's this miles long chain of humans just waiting to pull the sword. And when you can't pull the sword, they brand your wrist with a brand, so if they ever find anybody without that brand, they're like, yep, get on the boat, we're taking you right to the castle, let's do this. That was really cool.
That was cool. It's very King Herod rounding up all the 2-year-olds in Jerusalem. I thought that was really neat too. Although it sounds like, why wouldn't you just fake your brand? The second, 10% of the men in the realm get branded. Like, what's that look like? Oh, it's like, it's a V for Vortigern. Look, I've been tested. But,
well, do they know? I mean, the fate of the people who are, there's no like bad fate, right? You're not trying to necessarily avoid this. Because what if you pull the sword? Do they know that they're going to try and kill the person who pulls the sword?
Oh, right, because I forgot that Charlie doesn't understand that he's not... He doesn't understand that... Well, so he was, like, I guess sub-vote... He didn't... He was, like, a toddler when he got away. No?
Oh, yeah. He was pretty young.
Was he, like, under... So he probably does... Because you're right. He didn't know that he was King Arthur.
Yeah.
He didn't know that he was the rightful king, I should say. He didn't know he's the true heir. That was a shock to him as well. Okay, you're right. Yeah. So why would he hide? He just like, hey, because that's what he said. It's like, where do you want me? Let's get my brand and get out of here.
Yeah, or like, do the people who are up to pull this sword know that if they can pull the sword, they're going to be killed? Because, I mean, there's a weird perverse incentive there. Even if you could, if you just feel the sword moving, just don't stop trying, right?
Right. Like, so this king died, and I don't even
can't
remember.
Do it, guys.
Yeah, it's like this king died around the time I don't remember being born, and I grew up in a whorehouse, and if they find the rifle, they'll kill him. Maybe I feel kind of kingly, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. I guess there could be an assumption there. Like, if I pull this sword, I'm going to be killed because the king doesn't want to give up his throne to the born king.
Might as well. Yeah.
So maybe there is a little bit of danger there, but yeah, I don't know.
I have one question.
Okay.
What was your favorite Guy Ritchie ass scene of all the Guy Ritchie ass scenes in this movie? What's the favorite, your signature Guy Ritchie? Because I've got one in particular I really enjoyed.
I can't think of what they were actually doing, but it's the first one. It's the one
with Bruce Bolton where he says, "Tell me the story."
Yes. Yep. That's the one.
That was my favorite too. It's so good the way it kept on backing up. He's like, "Well," and the patter, where it's like, yep. "You met George. Is that Georgie Porgy? George DePore? The poor? No, it's Kung Fu George." And was that Bill? Was that Flat Top Bill? Bill the Dill? Or it was really entertaining. Specific. And Roos was with it. He was like nailing it. And the way all the friends jumped in, and the time went back and forth, and
yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. And you're getting an important narrative detail, right? It's not just like, oh, they're doing this stylistic thing, but the Vikings are concerned for him.
Right.
Because they've made a deal with the king, and they're under the protection of the king, and he's just kind of assaulted them. So now he's in danger, his whole crew, because he's not going to be protected. Yeah, it's good.
My least favorite is the one where he said, "Allow me to run you through the proceedings," and he like says what is going to happen if you go to these lords. Because the thing is, on that one where they jump to the future to show what actually happened, as far as I can tell, that never actually happens.
No, it's not a real flash forward.
It doesn't work. It's like they're having this conversation of force that never happens because they're having it at the bar, and I'm like, what? What?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought they're going to show how like they were doing a worked bit where he acts like an ignorant commoner. The Lord says something and Hansu says something diplomatic and then he has to like whip some. But it's just like, oh, no, this is not going to work. And it's like, well, what the fuck are we doing? That felt the only forced one. And it didn't work for me because of that.
Yeah, I agree. And then the, you know, assassination stuff that started to work again.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But it's not quite as good as the first one. The first one was really hit good.
I was also very confused when I first saw. I'm like, okay, this is clearly a very fictionalized story. Very fictionalized, even within its own legend. And when they did that montage at the beginning where they show, I keep wanting to say Voldemort, Vortigern, coming to power and Arthur growing up, they also showed London, which they caption it Londinium, and I'm like, okay, is this some fake made up one? Especially when I saw what I thought was the Colosseum in London, I'm like, yeah, this is fucking fake. And then they're showing me London Bridge over here to let me know that this is some mishmash of cultural history. Apparently not. London is like, I looked into this. London was called Londinium, and it was part of the Roman Empire at one time. It was an outpost. I had
no
idea.
That's insane. The amount of territory the Romans conquered.
Right?
It's sick. And that's the old Roman name for it.
Wild. Londinium. Never heard of it.
In Britannia.
Yep.
All right. I think that's it for our King Arthur Legend of the Sword. Unfortunately, we won't have a sexology of a podcast because they didn't make any more. But thanks for Commissioner's Podcast, PMH. I thoroughly enjoyed watching it. Maybe Jim less so, but I really liked it. And I can see why you're a fan. And it's a damn shame. I think I could have gotten down with a series of these to kind of break the monotony of the Marvel reign. Because you know we don't have a lot of like John Wick, like what are our big franchises right now? It's all been consumed by the Marvel machine. Could use a few palate cleanser action fantasy stuff. Maybe they can do something with the dungeons. Are they going to do another Dungeons and Dragons?
I hope so.
Yeah, I would. because this gave me that kind of vibes. I'm like, and I haven't seen it since I've seen the movie, and I think it's still on HBO. Maybe I'll watch that this weekend. But god damn, there's so much three-body problem. Anyway, thanks for the commission. You might be wondering at this point in the podcast, well, how the hell can I get Jim and Aaron to watch my favorite movie or a couple episodes of my favorite TV show, or I don't know, read a book of poems, anything that's about two-ish hours? Well, it's simple. You go to support.baldmove.com, click on commissions, you pay your money, you tell us what the thing that you want us to watch. I will get in touch with you and we'll handle the rest. Once again, thanks for PMH for Commissioners Podcast. We'll see you on another Pulp production soon. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Goodbye, everybody.